Morning all together. Welcome for Computer Graphics. Today we will speak about head-mounted displays again. Sorry for that we started with virtual reality, then we had the Unity demo on Monday. I hope that was interesting. And today we will make the second part on virtual reality and in particular on head-mounted devices, and in this part we will speak about the core component, I would say, of head-mounted displays, and that's the tracking part. Yeah, the tracking of the display is one of the major differences from normal computer graphics, where we sit in front of a screen. Of course, in fact, there are two things. The first one is the stereo rendering. We spoke about that last week. And today we will speak about the tracking part. Yeah. So how does that tracking work? And in particular, for head-mounted displays, there's a very important aspect, which is latency. That's the time between moving the head and seeing the change of that head movement on the display. And of course, that's very closely related to tracking, but it also means that in our rendering pipeline for head-mounted displays, we have to take this into account to keep that latency as low as possible. And yeah, that's a core component of virtual reality rendering. And that's what we will speak about then in the second part. Yeah, but it's all related to that tracking, to the fact that with a head-mounted display, when we move the head, yeah, automatically the image adapts to that head movement so that we feel immersed into that virtual environment. And tracking is very important, and good tracking is very important for HMD rendering. So first of all, it's very important that we have good, reliable tracking. We will see normal sensors that measure position, for instance, generate things like noise. Yeah, so the measurement is rather imprecise and moves back and forward continuously. If you would use that information for rendering in a head-mounted display, that would be horrible. Yeah, because the world around you would always be shaking. Yeah, and that definitely would not be a good experience. And another, probably more subtle aspect, I already said so, is that the latency must be low. That means, yeah, when we move the head, it immediate or as fast as possible should this movement should also be visible on the display. Yeah, otherwise, if there's a lag between head movement and seeing that on the screen, it quickly results in discomfort and people feel sick very quickly. Okay, so head tracking. Let's start with that part. How is the head tracked, or the display in space? So first of all, there are two components that we have to measure. The first one is the head orientation. Yeah. So when I rotate my head, yeah, maybe the position, the world position, yeah, doesn't change, but the orientation of the device changes. And yeah, this has a large impact on the rendering, yeah, so it needs to be measured. And it's something different from the position, yeah, so a GPS, for instance, as you know it from cars or from your mobile phones, it just delivers you a 3D world position, but it doesn't tell you the orientation of your mobile phone. And yeah, some of you probably know from your mobile phone, also for orientation, you have a sensor, a compass, and yeah, that's another degree of freedom in tracking that we have to follow. Yeah, so we have view direction or head orientation and head position. And for simple VR setups where you sit on a chair, for instance, yeah, often the head position is not important at all. So it's really only the head orientation that is to be tracked. But if we are in an environment where we can move freely and walk around a little bit, then also the head position is important. So we need these two different parameters, and of course the tracking must be fast. Yeah, which mainly means low latency. Yeah. Okay. So probably you know that on mobile phones, such position sensors that might help for our purpose are already available. And in fact, that's not so long that such sensors are available. We find that completely normal, yeah? But this is a rather new development. And yeah, probably the most well-known position sensor is a GPS on every mobile phone available, not expensive anymore. But I think you know that the precision of GPS is definitely not sufficient for a head-mounted display. It has something in the range of 10 meters, maybe a little bit less. But for instance, it usually doesn't work at all indoors, yeah, which is a killer criteria for virtual reality. Furthermore, it's very power-consuming, yeah, which is also can be an issue if we have a head-mounted display that has no power cable or so. There are also such displays. And yeah, it just doesn't work for our purpose. What can help is another sensor that you know maybe from your mobile phone. Yeah, if in Google Maps, for instance, you do not only see your position, but also the direction you're looking at. This is measured by a compass, yeah, or called magnetoscope. In fact, the compass does not only deliver north, south, east, yeah, the orientation, but it delivers a 3D vector that shows the magnetic field at the current point. And of course, this gives us orientation about the sensor, not only in this direction, but also up and down, yeah, because it delivers the 3D direction. But of course, rotations around the magnetic field cannot be measured. And in particular, indoors, again, now there's again the problem that there are many other sources of magnetic fields, in particular if you're working with computers. So often the magnetic field indoors, yeah, is mostly comes from electronic devices and other stuff. Yeah, so it doesn't show you the magnetic field of the Earth, but yeah, of that current position, and it can change while you walk around in a room. So absolutely, or the absolute direction of a compass is not reliable, but at least it works in a relative mode. That means if your magnetic field changes, yeah, or if this vector changes, that's a hint that you rotated the mobile phone somehow, yeah, and it can also give a hint into which direction, and yeah, so it is used, yeah, but it requires thought to use it. We will also come back to that, and also the magnetoscope is power consuming. Okay, so these are the probably best known sensors, but there are also two others. An accelerometer and a gyroscope. And these are relative position sensors. That means they don't deliver an absolute position like a GPS, yeah, that gives you coordinates on a map, yeah, where we currently are. An accelerometer doesn't give you an absolute position, but it tells you acceleration. Yeah? And of course, from acceleration, you can derive 3D position by integration, but this has disadvantages. We will see that in a minute. On the other hand, accelerometers are very fast. They don't require very much power. They are rather precise, but they, yeah, are relative. And the same for the gyroscope, which doesn't measure local changes in position, but changes in orientation. Okay, we will come back to these later on. So here we have a short overview of sensors. So we have absolute sensors, yeah, that really give us an absolute direction or position like GPS and the magnetoscope, and relative ones, accelerometer and gyroscope. The first row they work on position and these work on orientation. Yeah? And on a normal HMD, yeah, usually an accelerometer and a gyroscope are installed, maybe also a magnetoscope. GPS doesn't really help. Yeah? So we still need a way to get the absolute position of that HMD. And for these, typically special sensors are on board of such a HMD. And maybe you remember last week when I showed you or made a little demo, we had to build up that device, which is called a lighthouse in that case. And that's a special sensor that tracks the HMD, and we will also see how that works. Yeah, so let's start with position. Into orientation we will look later on. And yeah, as I said, usually these devices have special sensors. And one is, or a typical way to measure position in 3D space is realized here in this is the Oculus Rift, for instance. And what you can see here, this is a picture taken with an infrared camera. No, obviously not. But at least these points here are usually not visible. And what these are infrared lights. And you see they are arranged in a certain pattern. And then on the screen, so this is typically used sitting in front of a screen. And on the screen, there's a camera mounted like a web camera. That camera can see these points, yeah, and can recognize the pattern, and from the position of these points in the image, reconstruct the 3D position of the device. Yeah, so it's a typical, very simple computer vision problem. Find these points, detect the pattern, yeah, so that we know which point is which, and then we can reconstruct the 3D position of that device. So that works well, but only as long as you're sitting, really sitting in front of your camera. Yeah, if you stand up and obviously leave the range that the camera sees, yeah, there's no chance to track the position further. So if we want to move around freely, we need something else, yeah, something more complicated. And in fact, that's a very active area of research to build such tracking devices, yeah, that work in a larger range. Ideally, they should really work in entire buildings so that you can walk around freely, but that's from a technical point of view very difficult. The setup I've shown you last week works with these lighthouses. And here you can see one of these lighthouses. They were mounted on a tripod last week, yeah, but the important part was really only the small black box on top. And the idea is that these lighthouses are installed in the room where you want to do VR. So, of course, the idea of HTC is to install them in your living room. Ideally, two of them, yeah, and they somehow now manage to track the position of your HMD and also of these controllers. You remember I had these controllers, yeah, and they were also, of course, also their 3D position must be tracked so that I can grab things and so forth. And also their position and orientation is tracked using these lighthouses. And now the question is, how does that work? And in fact, that's a rather smart system, I would say. The tracking does not really happen on the lighthouses, but the tracking happens on the HMD. And it works the following way. The lighthouses, they emit a laser sheet. Yeah. So it's a laser line. Yeah. That then propagates like a laser sheet in the room. The light is infrared light, so we don't see it. And that laser sheet is moving or is swiping through the room. Yeah, it's swept in that case vertically. Yeah, so it's a horizontal laser sheet that's sweeping vertically through the room. Visualized here. And this is done by that lighthouse and by that lighthouse. And in fact, they do not only have a vertical sweep, but they also have a horizontal sweep, yeah, where the direction of the sheet changes. Yeah, so there's one sweep like this, and then one like this. Yeah, and then one like this, and like this. And in fact, the two lighthouses synchronize with each other so that there's only one sweep at a time. So normally what happens, yeah, we have these two lighthouses, and then there's this sweep, then this sweep, then this, then this, then this, this. Yeah, you can practice that if you're bored. Okay, yeah, so we have four of these sweeps, yeah, and then it starts again. And one of these sweeps, they are pretty fast, take about a hundredth of a second, yeah, so after rather these cycles are pretty fast. So in fact, here we can see, oh, that's a slow motion recording of such a lighthouse, yeah, so it has a little window where the light is emitted. And there you can see there's some mechanics that here generates these sweeping lasers. Yeah, so that one is maybe for horizontal, that's for vertical. And whenever one sweep is over, you see here these bright LEDs that then emit a flash. And the purpose of this flash is just synchronization. Yeah, the other lighthouse, yeah, can see that flash. So whenever this lighthouse here, yeah, made one swept the shield once, then it emits a flash, and so the other lighthouse always knows, yeah, when it's its turn. Yeah, so when these two sweeps were made, then this one takes over and sweeps, and with the flashes, this one then again knows when it's its turn. Yeah, so they with these flashes they can synchronize. Okay, so how does that help us? The idea now is the following. Here in the HMD, there are little sensors, yeah, light sensors. And whenever this laser shield is here seen by that diode here, by that sensor, yeah, then the head-mounted display knows, okay, now obviously my position is on that current sheet. Yeah, so the sensor, yeah, then sees always such flashes from these lighthouses, yeah, and it always sees a flash when this by that sweep, yeah, that sweep just reached the head-mounted display. Yeah, so it just sees such flashes. Yeah. Okay, and these flashes can now have two sources. They can be the synchronization flashes, or they can come from that sweeping laser. And in fact, if it measures the time between a synchronization flash and a flash coming from that laser shield, yeah, it can reconstruct the position of that laser shield, yeah, because it knows whatever it's worth 13 milliseconds, that's too much, let's say 2.5 milliseconds. So, yeah, then the laser shield was at that particular position, and so the device at least knows I'm somewhere on that plane. And next comes the horizontal sweep, yeah, again it sees a flash somehow, it knows the position, so it knows I'm at the intersection of these two planes, yeah, so it knows I'm on this line. And then comes the second lighthouse, and it does the same, so I know I must be on the intersection of these two lines, and this is a 3D point in space. Yeah, and by this, yeah, it can generate the position. The hardware is not difficult, not expensive. Yeah, it's just a little sensor that reacts to infrared light, and it just needs to measure the times between the flashes, and from this it then can reconstruct the 3D position in space. First, a little calibration has to happen, yeah, so that the positions of these sensors are known, but once they are known, then this is a very simple and fast way to compute the 3D position in space, and it scales very well, because the lighthouses are not the active parts. Yeah. So every device here just at particular points has a little diode that reacts to infrared light. Yeah. And from that signal, the position of that diode can be measured. And yeah, you can take essentially arbitrary many of these tracking points, and they all can measure their relative position or their position in space easily. Yeah, and with okay precision. Okay, yeah, is that understandable? I mean, this is just one technology, which was rather successful. And as I said, there are many other such tracking devices available. Yeah, so that's just exemplary for one of them. So as I said, yeah, there are cycles of these sweeps. One of these cycles takes about a 16th of a second. Usually, yeah, so with one cycle, now here is meant one cycle is a vertical and a horizontal one, yeah, and we need two. So usually we get 30 positions, or this device can deliver 30 positions per second, roughly. Yeah? And this is not enough. So such a head-mounted display usually has a frequency of 100 hertz or something in that range, yeah? So rather high image frequency, so 30 positions per second are usually not sufficient. So we will have to combine this with other sensors. But it delivers an absolute position, which is very helpful. Yeah, it's like a GPS, but in living room scale. So it delivers an absolute position, but we will have to use other faster sensors to really get also the fine, tiny movements. And such sensors are these relative sensors, or as such sensors, we can use these relative sensors that I've briefly explained before, the accelerometer and the gyroscope. Yeah, and these are usually called IMUs. IMU stands for inertial measurement units. Yeah, they measure inertia, Trägheit in German. With this they can measure acceleration. Yeah, that's a change in position, and also orientation, or in fact velocity of orientation changes. So that's angular velocity. And they are very fast. Such an accelerometer can work at usually 1,000 hertz, 1 kilohertz. That's the normal speed that also the very cheap accelerometer on your mobile phone has. Yeah, so these sensors cost whatever, 1 euro or something like that. So they're very cheap, rather fast, and very light. They don't require much power. So that's very, very useful. Now let's look at these a little bit in more detail. The accelerometer measures acceleration. Yeah, and as you probably know from physics, I hope you know that acceleration and force are the same. Yeah, they measure acceleration essentially by measuring a force. So they have a little mass, yeah, and then they measure the force on this mass. And in a normal setup, there's always a force on mass, and that's gravity. Yeah, so gravity is an acceleration that is always measured by these devices. Yeah, and you cannot separate acceleration from gravity and from moving around. So that's one factor that has to be taken into account. So when I take my sensor, yeah, and I do nothing, it always measures gravity, first of all. Yeah, and it has a direction, the acceleration. Yeah, gravity always points downwards, and the gravity vector, the acceleration vector that is measured in that case goes downwards. And if I rotate my mobile phone, yeah, then the acceleration changes with respect to the phone. Of course, not with respect to the Earth, but with respect to the phone. Okay, then if I'm jumping, yeah, then my sensor will measure these accelerations, yeah, these continuous accelerations. So it will measure also this curve of jumping up and down. And if I go to a carousel, then it will measure acceleration from the rotation. Yeah, so it will also measure the centripetal force, but always in combination with gravity. So the measured force will point into this direction, for instance. Yeah, so we always have to see it's a combination of my own movement and gravity that is measured. Okay, just little idea, how does that work? I said, instead of acceleration, a force is measured, a little mass for this is needed. And in fact, this is this looks like this. You need to imagine that that's tiny. Yeah, that's a very little structure here, these sensors. And they contain such a mass here, which is here number one, which is here connected to the entire device with a here small tiny bar so that it can move, yeah, not freely, but it can move up and down. And whenever now an acceleration is applied, it will move up and down, and this movement is measured because there are electrodes here. And if they get closer, then some currency changes, and this can be measured. And this tells us the relative position of that mass. And from this, the force can be derived, and this gives us acceleration. Yeah. And this is really tiny. Yeah, it's inside such a tiny chip. Yeah, but it's really mechanical. Yeah, it's not electronics; it's mechanical. Okay. Now, this gives us an acceleration. In fact, it gives us three accelerations. So three such sensors are contained, and they are arranged perpendicular to each other. Yeah. So we measure an orientation in X, in Y, and in Z direction. We get three acceleration vectors. And now you might say, okay, if we know acceleration, yeah, then we can also compute position. Yeah, you know, velocity is the first derivative of position, and acceleration is the second derivative of position. So to put it the other way around, if we take this acceleration and integrate, yeah, we get back to position. We always have this problem with these constants. Yeah, so integration always has this unknown constant. And this is simply, yeah, because from acceleration, we don't know the initial position. Yeah, we only know when the mobile phone or when this sensor has been turned off. It was at some position, and we can only measure relative to that position. Yeah, and but nevertheless, yeah. So by just measuring this acceleration, yeah, we can integrate this acceleration, and this gives us the velocity. Yeah, and if we integrate that velocity, we get the current position. And you see, for that, we need the starting position, and we also need the starting velocity. Yeah, so that is, if the object is moving with a constant velocity, no forces are generated. Yeah, so the acceleration is zero in that case. So with the accelerometer alone, you cannot differentiate, yeah, between HMD, or whether the sensor is at rest, or whether it's moving with constant velocity. For the accelerometer, it doesn't make a difference. And as you know, there's no such thing as absolute space anyhow. Yeah. But yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So accelerometer tells us somehow position, but also with some restrictions. Yeah. And in fact, the fact that we need double integration will have another consequence that we will see later on. And there's another point that we ignored. I said the sensor always measures the acceleration plus gravity. Yeah, and somehow we have to remove gravity from that measurement. Yeah, and that's not trivial, because that means, yeah. So if I change the orientation, of my device, yeah, then the direction of gravity relative to the device changes. Yeah, so I mean, I know that usually, in at least in our region, gravity is something like 9.81 meters per square second. I know the magnitude, but I don't know the direction, and it continuously changes with the orientation of my device. Yeah, and so to cancel that, I would need to know the absolute orientation of my device. And we will see in a minute that it's also not so easy, yeah, to get this one. So in this case, even these two, position and orientation, come together. Okay, so if we assume I know orientation, yeah, then I can also cancel out gravity, and then I really only have the acceleration due to a movement of my sensor, and with double integration I can get the current position. And yeah, how does this integration work? Yeah, we need to make some numeric integration. Probably some of you already heard about such numerical integration methods. The most simple way to do that is Euler integration. And here the idea is the following, that we say, okay, our accelerometer delivers measurements every at certain time steps, yeah, delta t. So the time ti is t0 plus I delta t. Yeah, so the ith measurement is at that time, if this is the time of the first measurement. And at this time, we measure ai. Yeah, so that's the acceleration that comes out of the sensor. That's what the sensor delivers minus the gravity. And now we simply integrate using that formula. Yeah, so that's a discretized version of integration. We take this acceleration times the time step and add this to the previous velocity, and this gives us the new velocity. Yeah, and if we have the new velocity, we can do exactly the same to get the new position. Yeah, so that's a very simple way to integrate. We could use other more complicated schemes that deliver maybe better results, but the principle is important now. Okay, and now we have a problem, yeah, because we integrate twice, yeah, and probably you know that this has a problem if there is noise on the original signal, or an error in the measurement, because then these errors accumulate. An error you make in one of these steps immediately results in a wrong velocity. Yeah? Once this sensor makes a little error or delivers a slightly wrong result, you will get a wrong velocity, and from that moment on, this wrong velocity will have an impact on all following measurements. Yeah? So these errors simply accumulate. Yeah? The longer you let that entire thing run, the wronger your result gets. Yeah, it's not errors that sort of cancel out, yeah, but they accumulate. And one of these consequences is that is so-called drift in that case. And here the idea is the following. So let's say you start with your device perfectly at rest. Yeah. So ideally, it should always say acceleration is zero. But of course, it will have slight errors, yeah. So it will deliver small values, 0.1, yeah, 0.002, maybe with a minus, and so forth. Yeah, it will always deliver small values. As a result, it will generate velocities, yeah, that are different from zero. Yeah, and these velocities or these errors, yeah, will these velocities, yeah, will become wrong. But they will slightly jitter. But now let's say we start moving around that object. Yeah, so I take it up. Yeah, I move it around a little bit, and then I put it back. It's very unlikely that when I put it back and it's at rest again, that velocity returns back to zero. Yeah, because there were many, many errors on the way that somehow accumulated, And in the end, yeah, even if it's perfectly at rest again, and even if it delivers very small accelerations, the velocity will no longer be zero. It will be some small amount. Yeah. And that would mean if you, for instance, take your controller, yeah, and measure position with such an accelerometer. Yeah. So at the beginning, it's good. Then you move around. Yeah. And hold it still. And in your image, it will slightly drift away. Yeah. It will have some remaining velocity and just drift away. And the sensor cannot differentiate it. Yeah. A constant movement also has acceleration zero. Yeah. So for the sensor, that's a perfect result. Yeah. But in reality, yeah, it's very annoying. Yeah, that your controller is just moving slightly. Or if you transfer this to these glasses, to these head-mounted displays, that would mean you move around, yeah, look around, and then you stand still, and you're virtually, yeah, your image is slightly moving. You're drifting away, even if you stand still. And that's very, very, very uncomfortable and very annoying. And it's essentially unavoidable. Yeah. And that's called drift. It's a result of this integration process. And it's, in particular for the accelerometer, it's pretty bad, yeah, because it has these double integration. Okay, so drift is a problem. Another problem is noise. Yeah, these sensors always have some slight chittering, yeah, and I mean, it's still, if you put up such a head-mounted display, it's still somehow observable that even if you're absolutely at rest and not moving at all, the image is always slightly chittering. You can always see if you look at single pixels, yeah, that around silhouettes, yeah, there's always a slight flickering from this still remaining little noise. Okay, good. So much for the accelerometer. It's very fast, yeah, it's cheap and has lots of advantages, but it has this drift problem. Yeah, that's the major problem of the accelerometer, and it's not absolute. For orientation, we have a very similar sensor. This is the so-called gyroscope, and this is not a gyroscope from a mobile phone. This is a gyroscope from an airplane. This is where this technology comes from. The German word is Kreiselkompass, so it's a heavy mass, yeah, like a something very heavy from iron or so. That's the one here in the center. And this entire thing is started by rotating this mass very, very quickly. Yeah, so there's a little engine or so, yeah, that rotates this mass very quickly. It's mounted to an axis, so it can rotate very quickly. And now it's a well-known effect that even if the rotation axis of this mass can also change freely. Yeah, we will see that in another image. I mean, it's not so well visible here, but the effect now is if you take that entire thing with a rotating mass and you rotate the entire thing, the rotation axis of the mass will remain. Yeah, the mass in the center will keep its absolute position even if you rotate the housing around. Yeah, that's a well-known physical effect. So here we can see how this mass is mounted. Yeah, so we say this rotor, this would be this mass now, and you know that. Yeah, that's a gimbal. Yeah, we were speaking about the gimbal lock when we spoke about rotations. That's exactly the same thing. So it has joints here that can freely rotate so that this axis here can move to an arbitrary position. And when I now move that gimbal, yeah, the rotation axis will always keep its position due to that rotating mass. Yeah, so we can take that as an absolute orientation. And by measuring these angles here, yeah, we would know how the housing, how that entire gimbal is rotated with respect to that spin axis. That doesn't change its absolute position anymore. Yeah, and this is used as a substitute for a compass in airplanes because it's more reliable, yeah, and more precise than a compass is. Okay, so here we can see this effect. It's a nice video, and that's a Yeah, okay. Probably, maybe some of you know what a CD player is. This is one in a space station. And yeah, now here you can see, yeah, without gravity, it just moves freely. But now if they turn on the CD player, now we have this rotating mass, yeah, the CD. So first of all, it rotates a little bit. Yeah, but now it's like one of these gyroscopes. And if they try to change the orientation, yeah, it always, there's always a force that forces it back to its original position. Yeah, so it always tries to get back to that original position. Yeah, and this we could use now for measuring orientation. Yeah, if we put that into a gimbal, yeah, and yeah, this is without rotation, and this is with rotation. And if we put it into a gimbal and we rotate around, yeah, we can measure how we changed orientation. Now he's turned off the CD and okay. Good. Now, in fact, yeah, for a mobile device, yeah, there's no chance to build something very heavy. But in fact, people made it to build something similar in such a small micro electromechanical system. Yeah, that's real mechanics, but it looks like a chip. They don't have rotating masses, but they have masses that are oscillating. This can generate the same effect. So there's really a mass oscillating, and whenever rotation changes, forces are generated that can be measured, and that measure orientation. In fact, for gyroscopes, so it's like an accelerometer. We don't need one, but we need three to measure orientation changes with respect to the three dimensions of space. As a difference, they don't measure acceleration, but they really measure angular velocities. So to get the absolute orientation, we only have to integrate once, which is better than for the accelerometer. Nevertheless, it's an integration step necessary, so it's a relative measurement. And yeah, it gives us angular velocities. So if we say, okay, at the beginning, our device is at some certain orientation, we take these velocities and integrate them, and this gives us then an absolute position. Again, with all these integration problems and so forth that we had before. Okay, so yeah, now let's see. We have quite some things together now. We have devices, special devices that give us absolute position, absolute tracking positions, but that are rather slow, maybe 30 hertz or something like that, yeah, as for the lighthouses. The precision is limited. For the lighthouses, it's in the range of 1 centimeter maybe, yeah, which is good, but for a head-mounted display, probably not enough, yeah. Also, slight movements should reflect. We get maybe a sort of absolute orientation from a compass with strong restrictions, but the problem is that indoor magnetic field sources are much stronger, or are often stronger than the magnetic field of the Earth. Yeah, so it doesn't really give us an absolute position, but it can give us a relative position if we say, okay, if the magnetic field vector changes, and we assume that at least in the small space we are moving, the magnetic field is constant, yeah, then at least we can get some relative position, and we need some calibration and so forth. But essentially, the compass is not very useful. Furthermore, we have from the accelerometer, that gives us relative position rather good, and relative orientation. The relative position from the accelerometer has the drift problem. And that's also another trick that is often used, that from the accelerometer, we can also, with quite some lag, determine gravity. just by saying, okay, if we average the result of the accelerometer over a longer time, yeah, then this gives us a very good approximation for the downwards direction, yeah, because it is very difficult to accelerate such an object constantly. Yeah, that would make it faster and faster, and quickly you're out of your living room. So usually acceleration only happens in very short intervals, and if we integrate over longer time, then this cancels out. Yeah, so if we integrate over the last second, for instance, we get a rather good approximation for the downwards direction. Yeah, that's the average acceleration, yeah, which is then dominated by gravity. Okay, yeah, so we have several pieces of information, yeah, about position, orientation. Some are related. Yeah, downwards direction, for instance, can also come from the accelerometer, and somehow all this has to be combined. And this is an art to do that correctly. Sensor fusion, yeah, is a difficult topic. There are disciplines, yeah, that work on that already since ages. And what is a typical way to solve that is to use a filter. The most general variant is the so-called Kalman filter, and a simplified version of that is rather easy to understand. In the end, it's the so-called complementary filter. And here the idea is usually that we want to combine results of multiple sensors. There are some that are very fast but imprecise, possibly also have drift, yeah? And there are other sensors that are slow, but that give us, for instance, also an absolute position, yeah? And we want to combine these two now, and a typical way, or if we look at position, for instance, yeah, the fast relative sensor would be the accelerometer, and the slow absolute sensor would be the lighthouse, and we can combine now these two in the following way, that we say, okay, the slower sensor gives us low frequency information. So we say, okay, we apply a low pass filter to the slower sensor, and the low pass filter simply means we always average over the last n measurements. Yeah, this removes noise, but it also removes all that chittering that we have in the signal. Yeah, also the lighthouses, they always deliver slightly different positions, yeah, and by averaging over the last ones, yeah, we remove that noise, but of course now we also have some lag, yeah, because we take information, old information, into our position. And to reduce that, we'd now take the fast sensor and remove all that low frequency part. Yeah, we apply a high pass filter. That means we apply a low pass filter and subtract it from the original signal. Yeah, so from the accelerometer, we just take these fast movements that they can measure much better. Yeah, and then we simply combine the two. Yeah, we add the slow absolute, much more reliable position from the slow sensor, and the fast movements come from the accelerometer. And we combine the two with larger weights for the fast sensors, lower weights for the slow sensors. And what that also helps is that by just looking at the high frequency part of the accelerometer, we remove the drift from the accelerometer and replace it by the slower moving sensor, like, for instance, from the lighthouse. Yeah. So that's a rather, I mean, of course, that's in the end, it's complicated to find the right weights and so forth. Maybe even have more than two sensors, yeah, then we need even more weights and so forth. But that's a general idea. Yeah, just take different frequency components of the different sensors and combine all them. And as I said, this can be generalized. That's the so-called Kalman filter, which is, I think, well known for being very difficult to understand. but essentially, yeah, it does the same, but with higher dimensions and so forth, and mathematically rather complex. And in UAVs, that means drones and all these, also such filters are of course needed. Yeah, they have exactly the same problem, that they need to measure position and orientation and so forth. And there's a filter, Mahoney filter is used, which is also a variant. Yeah, but in the end, they are rather similar. Of course, again, if you use such an HMD, you don't need to be aware of all these filters and don't need to implement that. That's done by the SDK. But it definitely makes sense to know where this information is coming from and why sometimes it's maybe not what you expect, yeah, or where the problems are. But in general, for HMDs with such lighthouses or other trackings and these sensors, it is possible to get robust position and orientation also at high speed. Okay, so now let's say that part is solved. Yeah. Now we still have the latency problem. Yeah. Whenever the user moves the head, we can measure that movement. Yeah. We can measure the new position. And we can measure the orientation, and it works rather fast. So these sensors have high frequencies, yeah, 1 kilohertz, yeah, and because they only measure the high frequency part, yeah, we really get 1 kilohertz at 1 kilohertz new positions, yeah, that are always only corrected, so to say, by the lighthouses or pulled into the right direction. But we have positions at very high frequencies. And so that means, yeah, when the user moves the head, we very quickly know that the head has moved. Yeah? But now we still have to try to make the time until this movement also reflects on the screen. We have to make that time as small as possible. Yeah? So even if the head tracking is very fast, yeah, usually in less than 10 milliseconds, yeah, or more in the range of 1 millisecond, we still have the rendering. Yeah? Now our engine knows, okay, the head has been moved. Now we need to render a new frame. We have to take the new camera matrix and now regenerate a new image. And now let's say our scene is not too complicated, so we can render our scene at 10 milliseconds also. Yeah, that means at 100 hertz, which is doable. Yeah, on even in computer games today. Yeah, so together, if we sum that up, we will end up at something like a latency of maybe 20 milliseconds. Yeah, and in fact, that's usually already considered as too much. So we have to try to bring that down. And to bring that time down, yeah, we also have to look at our pipeline, how we do all that rendering and how we can reduce that time as much as possible. There's here, if you're interested in more details, there's a nice talk of Alex Flachos, who is one of the developers of the HTC Vive, and he explained all the nitty details, yeah, how they brought down the time by millisecond for latency to increase comfort more and more. And a few of these ideas I would like to present here, yeah, because it really has an impact on how we implement our pipeline. If we also do VR, different from how to do that if we view our scenes on a screen. So let's look at the normal timeline when we do graphics up to now. In the beginning of the lecture, I was already speaking about the V-Sync. And the idea here is the following. Our screens usually display image by image at a certain frequency, normally 60 hertz. Yeah, such normal screens at notebooks or mobile phones, they typically have a frequency of 60 hertz. That means every 60th of a second, a new image is transmitted to the screen. This image is then displayed from top to bottom, yeah, while the data is transferred. And when it's at the end, yeah, sometime nothing happens, and then it starts again from top to bottom. And this event that it starts, or a new screen starts, is called the V-sync, the vertical sync. And when we render, yeah, or in our render loop, usually whenever a new image has been or is started to be transmitted, yeah, is the moment when we start to render the next frame. It doesn't make sense that if we only render 60 frames per second, it doesn't make sense to render 200 frames per second, yeah, because then only every third frame that we render is displayed, yeah, all the others are rendered and then immediately overwritten by the next ones. Yeah, we have these double buffers, but okay, yeah, I already spoke about that. Okay, so that's the normal pipeline that we also use in the exercises, for instance, yeah, because there's this swap buffer method, yeah, that swaps back and front buffer, and this method usually implicitly waits for the next vsync. Yeah, so when your image is ready, you call swap buffers. Swap buffers just waits until the current front buffer is completely transmitted and displayed, yeah, and then it switches and starts to transmit the newly rendered buffer. Yeah, and in that time until the vsync, yeah, then usually nothing is done. That would be a waste of energy to do something here, yeah, because the new frame is ready. Starting a new frame doesn't make sense, yeah, because before the old frame has to be shown on the display, and when that process starts, we can override the previous front buffer as new back buffer and render our next frame. Okay, so in this scenario, if we say, okay, here, when we render, we read the sensors, yeah, we read the new position of our head-mounted display, we get all the new matrices, and then we render, yeah, and from that moment on, yeah, the new image is shown, then we have a latency of 16 milliseconds. Yeah, because here the head position is red, and from here on, it becomes visible, the new rendering becomes visible. And 16 milliseconds is probably already too much. Yeah? Or, yeah, just, I mean, there are experiments, yeah, that try to find out what a latency is that cannot be perceived, yeah, and the results are very different. But 16 milliseconds is probably already, or maybe just okay. But it should be less. Okay, and in fact, things are more complex. So, first of all, usually we do not only have a render loop, yeah, but in our virtual world, if we have a computer game, we also have simulation, for instance. Yeah, we want our objects to move, we want to animate our characters, we want to make some physics simulation for the whatever bullets that are flying around, stuff like that. Yeah, so we also have some simulation, and usually we first of all have to simulate. Yeah, then if all objects are at the new 3D world positions, we can start the rendering, and before we render, we have to read our sensors, yeah, so that we know the new view position, and then we make all these calls to the GPU, and then the GPU is starting to render. So this bottom line here is what happens on the GPU, and this is what usually happens on the CPU. Yeah? And now you see, due to the simulation and so forth, yeah, this time needed here, we have less time for rendering. And in fact, here all this time, the GPU is idling and has nothing to do, yeah, because it waits for the next vsync and until this next process can start again. Okay, so that would be a naive implementation, but of course, yeah, we can better use CPU and GPU in parallel by always starting the simulation immediately after these GPU calls have been sent. Yeah, and ideally, yeah, then at this point at the vsync, we have the new simulation results and can immediately start with a rendering. Yeah, so that's, I would say, a rather obvious optimization that we better use these gaps in between. But there's also another point that contributes to latency that we've ignored up to now, and that is usually if we render such an image, and here there's a vsync, That doesn't mean that at this point the image immediately becomes visible on the display, but instead the entire image first has to be transferred. Yeah? Now the image is on the GPU in some buffer, and now it has to be transmitted via a cable, usually, to the display, and the display builds up its image from top to bottom. Yeah? So for the last line of the screen, it takes almost yet an entire 16 milliseconds maybe until the last line is visible. Yeah? So also the display has latency. And this also significantly contributes to the overall latency. And in fact, I mean, software-wise, there's nothing we can do about that, but it mainly means that in these HMDs, displays are needed that are very fast. Yeah? So transmission should be very fast, so that after the VSync, they as fast as possible show the current result. And in fact, that's something that is also well known in the gamer community, not for head-mounted displays, but for normal TV sets. Normal TV sets here have an extremely high latency because they do not only transmit the signal or receive the signal and display it, but very often they do much image processing on these images. Yeah, they maybe also interpolate frames to get higher frame rates and stuff like that. They make adaptations of brightness and optimizations of the image, and that often is in a pipeline that can take multiple frames. Yeah, so many TV sets have something like a delay of 5 frames. Yeah, while an image is transmitted, it takes 5 frames until it's really shown on the display. And that's very bad for gamers. So there are websites around where you can see for every TV how high that latency is. Yeah, and the lower the latency, the better it is for playing games, because then 5 frames is definitely feelable. If you watch a movie, it doesn't matter. Of course, the sound is delayed accordingly. Yeah, so it doesn't matter if you're whatever a tenth of a second late, but if you have to react, yeah, then it makes a difference. And these displays, yeah, then need to be very fast. But there's nothing we can do software-wise on that. Okay, and all this time, we are still now here have in this example maybe 2 frames, so that would be 32 milliseconds. Of latency, yeah, which is already quite much. And this is the so-called time motion to photons. It's the time between a sensor position has been read, so in fact that bar should start here at the end of read sensors, until it is really visible on the screen in the end. Okay, sorry, slides are a bit out of order. Okay, yeah, this is what we spoke about with this display rate, sorry. Okay, yeah, and this now is what I said. So this is the webpage displaylag.com. I don't know, maybe it doesn't exist anymore, but if you look there, you can really see for every or for all larger companies that make TVs, yeah, how long the lag is between transmitting an image and seeing it on the display. And for some TV sets, it's in the range of 100 milliseconds, yeah, which is already quite much. Okay, good. So one other aspect on displays, which is also, I think, nice or interesting, is the following. In your head-mounted display, usually these head-mounted displays are completely locked. So that means it's completely dark in there. And brightness is not an issue. Yeah, it's not like a TV set that you should also be able to see an image when the sun is shining. But yeah, it's really in a completely dark environment. And so what often is done is that so-called global displays are used. And that means they try to avoid that the image on the screen is built from top to bottom. Yeah, so that first the first line becomes visible and so forth, yeah, from top to bottom. But global displays, what they do is the following. Usually such a screen has a backlight that generates the light. Yeah, and then there's just the LCD itself just blocks this light. Yeah, but white means a pixel is transparent, and so the entire backlight becomes visible. So what global displays do is that most of the time this backlight is turned off, it's black. And the image is then built completely, yeah, while the backlight is black, so you don't see how the image is generated from top to bottom. And when the last line is ready, then the backlight is turned on for some time. Yeah, really only for a fraction of the entire time, maybe something like 10%. Yeah, so the complete image becomes visible at one moment from top to bottom. Yeah, and then it's only visible for 10% of the time, then the backlight is turned off and the new image is loaded to the screen. So in fact, yeah, the image is flickering a lot, but at such a high frequency that normally people don't see it. Okay, so this sounds like mainly disadvantages. Yeah, so it's flickering. The brightness, of course, also goes down to 10%, which is not a problem, as I said before, but it has a big advantage. And this is the so-called motion blur problem. And there's a nice demo here. Oops. Here it is. And now I will turn off. What you should try and do is look at the lower UFO. Can you see the effect? Does it work on the projector? Yeah. What you see, yeah, is this square pattern. Yeah, there's obviously a pattern in comparison to looking at the one on top. Yeah, if you look at the one at the bottom, yeah, you see this weird effect. You can change that to whatever stars. Okay, it's little boxes. Yeah, but I think that one is very obvious, right? And just if you look at the top, yeah, you still see that things are moving. But if you look at the lower one, yeah, you can clearly see the single boxes, and the effect can be explained. Oops, can be explained easily. I will turn that off otherwise. The problem is the following. Imagine you have this moving object. We can also see it only with a moving object. You have a moving object, and now while it moves, you're tracking the object with your eyes. Yeah, so yeah, you're following the object with your eyes. Now, what is the effect during one frame? So your gaze direction, your view direction, yeah, is moving from here to here, yeah, and you see that UFO in a certain time period, yeah. So, and in during one frame, during 1/60th of a second, on a non-global display, yeah, on a normal display, for a sixteenth of a second, you see the UFO here, yeah, and then for the next frame, it is here. And then it is here, and so forth. Yeah, but while you track it, you constantly move your eyes. Yeah, that is, while during a frame, your eye moves from here to here. So your eye, yeah. So relative to your eye movement, the object is still. So you see it blurry. It the object itself is static. Yeah, but your eye is moving. So on your retina. Yeah, your retina also integrates over time, so it sees, the retina sees a blurry image. Yeah, And here it also sees a blurry image for the next frame. So overall, moving objects become blurry. It's not possible. Yeah, ideally, you would need eyes, yeah, that can, with a 60th of a second, move. Yeah, but that's not possible. They can only move constantly. Yeah, so your eye integrates, and so it's very difficult to follow constantly moving objects on normal displays. But with such a persistent display here, such a global display, at least, yeah, we only see that object for a very short time, but in that time, the eye is also moving much less. Yeah? And now I might say, okay, but in between I see nothing. That's also not very good. But in fact, the brain somehow can much better cope with that situation than with a constant illumination or constant light from the other screens. And so on these low persistence displays, this effect is noticeably better. Yeah? And of course, in a game scenario, for instance, it's very important that you are able to track objects without this motion blur effect. Okay, but that's just a neat side remark. Yeah, I also liked that demo, so I thought that might be an interesting thing. And I only know that it's used in head-mounted displays. I never heard that it's used on a TV or on a monitor, probably because of the brightness limitation. Okay, now for HMDs that's desirable, yeah, but on latency it even has the bad impact, yeah, that now the latency even for the top lines, yeah, is increased by another time for the entire display, yeah. So before it was only for the lower part, latency was highest, now it is the highest for all the lines. Yeah. So on latency, again, it doesn't have a positive impact. And it again shows that these displays maybe mainly should be very fast. Okay, good. So what can we do about that software-wise? Yeah. So we are still in that pipeline. Yeah. We say we wait for the V-Sync, then we read the sensors, we render, and then comes the new V-Sync here. This time we don't have any control for the transmission, but at least at this part here, yeah, we can try to improve latency or to reduce latency. How could we do that? And one possible solution would be that we use motion prediction. That means we say, okay, let me go back here. When I read these sensors, I know where the head is at that moment, but if I also look at the positions from the previous frames, yeah, I might be able to predict the position the head is at that moment when the image is visible. Yeah, I just predict where the head will be when the corresponding image is visible. Yeah, and that assumes, yeah, that normally people are moving, yeah, rather smoothly, yeah, and if my head is moving constantly in that direction, it's very likely that in the next frame it will also continue to move into that direction, yeah. And this is a motion prediction. This is well known how to do that. In fact, what we do is that we do not only track the position of the viewer, but also its velocity and maybe also its acceleration. And then we assume that also during the next frame, the velocity and the acceleration stay the same. And this gives us a kind of extrapolation of the position. And we use this extrapolated position to render our current frame.
It's a typical prediction thing. Yeah, if we assume it's constant, we make some error, and the smaller the approximation scheme, yeah, the better the prediction is. But of course, it will fail. Yeah, if we make rapid hap movements or further, then prediction becomes more and more difficult. Yeah, but it's usually included also some motion prediction. Yeah, and here this is this error plot where we can see some movement, and without prediction we get this error in degrees. Yeah, and with motion prediction, it can rather well be reduced. Okay, so that's one way. What else can we do? A rather obvious optimization would be the following, that we say, okay, of course, or usually, or often at least, our GPU has some gap here where it is just idling, simply because it is so fast, yeah, that there is still some room now for optimization, that we can delay the rendering, yeah, and move the rendering backwards so that this time here where we read the sensors, so that we don't have to read the sensors immediately after the vSync, but we wait a little bit longer, yeah, and then read the sensors and then issue the render calls and then hope that we are ready in time, just in time for the next vSync, yeah? Then at least this time we've reduced the latency. Of course that works, but it means that we really need to know the render time here. We need to be sure that when we start here, yeah, we are ready here. So we shouldn't start too late, yeah, because if we miss that time here, yeah, we lost a complete frame. Yeah, and you know that's very annoying, yeah, if scenes get stuck for a moment. Yeah, that would exactly be this effect for a very short time, but that's still noticeable. Okay, so yeah, that somehow works, but it only works if our scene is so simple that we really have that the rendering is so fast, yeah, that this effect becomes noticeable. And the danger is high, yeah, that we lose, yeah, because our rendering is not ready in time. Okay, so that's not really a good solution, but there's another solution that is implemented on these headsets, and this is the following. The idea here is the following. As soon as the vSync happened, we render. And now let's assume we still have here a time budget left. Yeah. So now our image is ready, and now we still have some time left. And what is done here now is the following. Once the image is rendered, the sensors are read again. Yeah. Now the new position is determined. Yeah. So from here to here, some time has gone. Yeah. So here now we have a much more current new head position. And then we take that previous rendering here and warp that image to reflect, yeah, kind of that late movement, yeah, that late information that arrived. We use that information to warp the image a little bit, yeah, so that this new the previous rendering now is adapted and reflects that new position. Okay, and how can this warping be done? Yeah, so let's look at a very simple example. Yeah, so let's say I'm moving my head. Yeah, then at this position the image is rendered. Yeah, and while it is rendering, I'm moving my head further to the right. Yeah, then the rendering is done. The sensors are read, so it sees, okay, now the head has moved. Yeah, and moving the head right, we can reflect by simply moving the image a little bit to the left, right? Yeah, so we simply now take that new information, that new measurement here, yeah, and simply move our image on the screen a little bit to the left again. Yeah, and so we compensate for that unforeseen right movement. And this would be such a warp here. Yeah, would simply be moving the image. That means, of course, when we move the image, we have the problem that some of the image gets lost, yeah, and some other part, yeah, we don't have information. Yeah, if we move to the left part will become black or something like that.
So we can solve that by always rendering our image too big, yeah, so that we have a margin around, and then in the end can still shift around a little bit, yeah, and we know which information we have to introduce from the side. So that is doable, yeah, but there's another problem, and that is moving my head to the right and moving the image to the left is not the same, unfortunately. It's roughly the same, but it's not exactly the same. And the reason is rather simple. So let's say here we have a scene, yeah, and here is our camera, our eye, yeah. So this is our head-mounted display, okay? And now from here I render this image, yeah, and now we can already see, I can, here from that cube, I can see this side. And if I look at the occlusion, yeah, then from here on, this part of the back wall will be occluded, right? Now, if I move the camera a little bit to the right, yeah, now suddenly this side is no longer visible. Yeah? And also the occluded part of the wall changes. That part now is occluded, and even worse, that part gets unoccluded. Yeah? Now from this position, that part is visible, and from here it was not visible. So that part is not even visible in that image. Yeah? Something becomes visible that was not visible before. So only by moving that entire image, we cannot really compensate that. So here we can see such a result. I mean, this image warping is a very old idea. Yeah, the idea is always take one image from a particular view and then generate new views from that. Yeah, so that in many applications that can help to make a faster rendering. Yeah, just take the previous image and generate the next ones from this single image without rendering the entire scene again. But here are typical results that happen here. So for instance here, so this is a lounge chair, and here we can see such disocclusions. Yeah, so that's exactly this effect here, that here the camera moved upwards, and so suddenly regions become visible that were not visible in the previous frame. So this image has been generated with this loop here. The idea is we take the original image. For each of these, for each pixel of this original image, let's say we also stored its 3D position, and then we can project this 3D point to our new view. Yeah? So we take all the pixels and project them at the appropriate position in our new view. But as a result, such disocclusions will appear. And it will also happen that sometimes one pixel or two pixels are mapped to the same pixel. And in the other, that also automatically means that some pixels of the target image get no information from the previous image. So such stripe patterns appear, and so forth. Yeah. So, of course, one can try to fix this stuff and to do in painting, yeah, to invent new information for these or to fill in these holes by simple interpolation. But it's always a little bit prone to artifacts, but there's one interesting exception, and this is warping works very good if we don't move our camera, but if we only rotate. If we take that same situation here, yeah, and now say, okay, now we rotate our camera. We don't move it, we only rotate it. Yeah. Then as a result, yeah, here the occluded areas are still exactly the same because the position of the camera hasn't changed, just the rotation. And yeah, in fact, it can quickly be shown that if we have one image from one camera point with one particular direction, if we keep the point, yeah, and only rotate the view, yeah, then we can do a warp without error, without disocclusions, and so forth. Yeah, we can do that perfectly. And yeah, this is now something that is exploited here, yeah, because we very often, in particular, if we are sitting, head rotation is more important than head movement. And with this warping technique, yeah, we can compensate head movement. And we can now do exactly this. We render our image. We render it a little bit larger than needed, yeah, so that at the boundary we have information for the warp, yeah. Then the sensor is read again, and then a warping happens, yeah, exactly such a warping process, but only considering the new rotation, not the new position, but only the new head rotation. And this warping now just takes every pixel of the original image and moves it to a new position in the new image, or the other way around, yeah. Every pixel of the new image is fetched from the old image, so that's a rather fast process, and it's a process that can be very well predicted, yeah, because it doesn't depend on scene complexity or something. It's just a loop over every pixel, yeah, so we can very precisely predict how long that takes. We know how long reading the sensors takes, so we exactly know at which time we have to start that warping process. And the warping will just be ready for the next V-sync, and as a result now, yeah, the latency is really reduced to the latency of that step here, yeah? Essentially. And that's much less than here for the entire rendering part. And yeah, as I said, yeah, this is implemented on these. Yeah, it's transparent. You don't really see it. Essentially, it's a little bit like swap buffers, but before swapping the buffers, it also does this time warp. Yeah. And that helps a lot to reduce latency. Here again, a link to a video where this entire thing is nicely explained, if you are interested in more detail. Okay, so summary. Tracking is a core problem of head-mounted displays. Not only for tracking the head-mounted display, but also for controllers and so on that we need in virtual reality. It should ideally work for multiple people, so that multiple people can work in such a space and can maybe even interact, work together on virtual stuff and so on. Yeah, so it's really a core problem of virtual reality. How can we track devices and maybe even also the persons that are working together? And yeah, there's definitely no final solution for that yet. It's well researched, or many people look into that, and always new solutions become available. But tracking is not the only thing, or latency is another issue. Yeah, and in fact, latency is one of the major problems when people are wearing head-mounted displays for a longer time. Some have less problems, others have more problems. Virtual reality is one of the techniques that has been also very much used by military. I also spoke about that in the introduction of particular augmented reality. And of course, they examined that very well, how big the impact of latency is, yeah, because I mean, yeah, it doesn't make sense if a soldier then after 10 minutes says, oh, I have to take it off for some time. Yeah, please wait. So they examined that very well, and they even came to results. I read things like that. They said if a soldier wore an HMD for more than 2 hours, he shouldn't drive a car for another 24 hours or so. Yeah, it really can have a very big impact, and some people still are not able to wear such HMDs for longer than a few seconds. They immediately throw up. And probably latency is one reason, and this vergence accommodation conflict are also known to be one problem, but maybe there are also other effects that we are not aware of yet. Okay, good. But we saw latency can be reduced technically, and also with algorithms, with these warping techniques and so on, but maybe there are also other ideas around that help to do that even better in the next years. Okay, so much for that. We now have 2 weeks left for the lecture. Just to remind you, I told you that we compress, or not compress is the wrong word, yeah? So the entire lecture is 4 hours a week, but only until Christmas, yeah? So officially it's 3 hours. So we will have 2 other weeks, and in that time we will look into ray tracing. Ray tracing is an alternative technique for rasterization. Rasterization is mainly rendering implemented on a GPU, so for fast graphics like virtual reality. And now we look at the other side of the spectrum. Ray tracing is much slower than rasterization, but the big advantage is that we can add nice illumination effects that are very complex or difficult in rasterization. So we can easily add shadows, we can easily add reflections, for instance, with ray tracing. Yeah, so we are slower, but we can generate nicer images. And in fact, probably every movie that you, or CG-generated movie that you can see today has been generated by ray tracing, not by rasterization, just for that reason. Yeah, and this is what we will look into for the rest of the lecture. Next Monday, we will start with ray tracing. Thank you.